From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. It's good to have friends in the course of the years of doing this show, and it's good to have an old friend sitting right across from me, our old friend Joe Berlinger, who was last here with Crude.
Yes.
We stirred up a little bit of trouble with that.
But we
did. He's been stirring up trouble for the last 25 years. Before we started, I was saying that in terms of the true crime documentary, he's one of the pioneers of that, going way back to Brother's Keeper, his new film, which looks at another bigger and different kind of crime, a crime on so many levels, is a new film, Intent to Destroy. First of all, Joe, thanks for coming back.
Elvis, always great to see you. I can't believe it's been since Crude that I haven't chatted with you officially. I've seen you around.
But. Yeah, but but it's interesting because you tended to take on these big topics, but I don't think you was being, strictly speaking, a documentarian, because for me, they're always pieces of storytelling for you, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, interestingly, with Brother's Keeper, you know, we came in as storytellers with no social justice component. It wasn't until Paradise Lost, when we saw Damien Echols being chained up and led to death row, that kind of activism gene awakened in me. So, you know, I came into filmmaking, you know, along with Bruce Sanofsky, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago. But when we made Brother's Keeper, it was purely an aesthetic decision to try to push the documentary form in our own way. So storytelling to me has always been paramount. You know, you can make a thesis film full of all sorts of facts and figures about any kind of subject you want to advocate for, but if you don't reach people emotionally, it's not going to be as effective as, you know, trying to find a storytelling approach to telling a complicated story.
And for me, part of that has always been that you, strictly speaking, are not interested in the Talking Heads documentary.
Yeah. That is true, which makes Intent to Destroy kind of an interesting exercise, because there is some Talking Heads and archival footage. But for me, you know, this whole idea of jumping out a window and hoping there's a mattress on the other side to catch you, where you don't know where the story is going and you follow it in the present tense, has always been fascinating. Now, today it's a lot, you know, easier to do that, and people might think, well, what's the big deal about following a story? I'll grab my video camera. But back in the day when we made Brother's Keeper, we were still shooting documentaries on film. And just, you know, from a practical level, we shot Brother's Keeper, you know, we had no funding, we were paying for it ourselves, and every 10 minutes of, I think what younger filmmakers don't remember, is when we were shooting 16, if you had this crazy dream of wanting to show your movie in a movie theater back then, which we did, you know, documentaries in the movie theater was not that common. In fact, it was the exception rather than the rule, but that was our dream with Brother's Keeper. And, you know, you had to originate on celluloid back then. Today, you can shoot on digital. Exhibit on digital. In the 90s, you could shoot on tape and then transfer it to celluloid. That was popular for a while. But when we started shooting Brother's Keeper, you know, if you wanted to exhibit in a theater, you had to originate on 16 mil, and so, video wasn't even, you know, really, it was still in its infancy. And every 10 minutes of raw footage, you know, 16 millimeter came in these 10 minute rolls. By the time you shot your 10 minutes, developed it at a lab, then sunk it up on your Moviola or your Steinbeck with the separate sound, it cost you $400 for every 10 minutes, and you saw it a week later. So this idea of making a film in which you don't know what the outcome is, where you jump out a window and you hope there's a mattress on the other side to catch you, where with Brother's Keeper, I mean, look, we were standing on the shoulders of amazing cinema verite filmmakers from the 60s, so it's not like we invented this, but it took a huge leap of faith to go follow a story where you don't know what the outcome is.
Even these crime stories you guys are doing, and you're still doing it again, the point is that you want to make that, I hate to use the word immersive, but emotionally story.
Absolutely.
Emotional storytelling, so that people don't make a supposition about what it is you're saying. You're not, even in the case of your later films, you weren't trying to say, well, this is the point you should follow. I'm not advocating here. I'm just trying to show you the world, and you as a viewer make your own decision about it.
Exactly. I mean, I've always felt like you have to treat the audience like a jury. You give them the pros, you give them the cons, and let them decide, because I have confidence and faith in viewers that the truth rises to the top. I mean, the greatest example to me of that is the first Paradise Lost film, you know, is just great cinema verite. you know, we allow everyone to be heard, and we don't bang a message over your head that this is a wrongful conviction film.
It's possible to watch that film and not be swayed by it.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reactions that was so interesting to observe Brothers Keeper, when it came out, just created the most intense, still to, of any film I've done in the last 25 years, that's the film where the Q&As were packed, where people just stayed, wanted to talk, and just provoked a lot of dialogue. But, you know, 20% of the people who saw that film, even though to me it was a film about, you know, justice gone awry, poor man's justice, a wrongful conviction, for me, it was clear what the film was about, but 20% of the people who saw that film thought they saw a film about guilty teenagers, which I was okay with because...
That many?
Yeah, I was okay with that because 80% of the people who saw the film, because they were allowed to come to the conclusion themselves and not had a message beat over their head, 80% of the people were so persuaded of their innocence because they came to the conclusion, not that they were told, they came to the conclusion themselves. They went out and not only, you know, in the theater felt an injustice, they went out and continued and agitated, and that's why the West Memphis Three ultimately got out of prison. The films are given a lot of credit, and they were a catalyst, but it's the tens of thousands of people who actually, you know, didn't just allow a message of a film to wash over them, but they went out and remembered the story and advocated for their innocence. And if it wasn't for those many regular people and people like Johnny Depp, Eddie Vedder, Peter Jackson, all the people who saw Paradise Lost and did something about it, if it wasn't for those people, those guys would still be Damien would be dead by now. And that's, you know, that goes back to my basic philosophy of filmmaking, which I believe you really, you know, some advocacy filmmakers make a mistake in thinking that they have to like lay a very specific point of view and beat it over the head of the person viewing, and anything that might detract from a scrubby, clean image that you want to present should be left out of the film. And I just feel the opposite. You have to show both sides, treat the audience like a jury. And so when the audience member is evaluating the information, if they come to the conclusion themselves that they've just witnessed an injustice, that's a very passive, that's a very active experience, rather. And when you have this active experience of coming to your own conclusion, it activates you. If you're in the audience and just being lectured to by a filmmaker with a singular point of view, it's a very passive experience. And it can be persuasive in the moment, but I don't think when those people leave the theater, they're going to do anything about what they've seen for the most part.
It's the treatment. We're talking to our old friend Joe Berlinger, whose new film is Intent to Destroy. I think, though, part of it has to be, for you as a filmmaker, you're going to be turned on by the film, the subject yourself.
Absolutely.
And people are like that. You talked about the way people are... were seeing those early films, but I would imagine that was certainly, we talked about it here with Crude, and I know it must have been the case with I Am Not Your Guru, where people want to sit around afterwards and talk about it, because there is a sense of discovery in the filmmaking itself.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, that's a great point. You know, for me, you know, I've now been doing this long enough, and I sort of very recently, it was actually with Not Your Guru that I realized that, you know, I used to get very frustrated at what films I got to make and what films I didn't, even though I feel very lucky to be doing this for 25 years. Frustrated at the idea, you know, certain films that I would pitch and hope that would come together didn't, and certain films, you know, have come together. And I've been lucky that I've made some really cool films, but I could never figure out the rhyme or reason about which films actually get made and which don't. And I realized very late in my career, and it came from Not Your Guru, is that the films almost choose me as opposed to I choose them, because they come at a time in my life when I need to hear that particular lesson. You know, Brothers Keeper, you know, totally flipped my world around about being judgmental towards people. Not to give you a sob story, I grew up in, you know, kind of a tough situation, and it produced in me kind of a insecurity, and insecurity translates into being very judgmental about other people. And along comes my first film, Brothers Keeper, where you enter into the world of people who don't change their clothes for a year, who you might have been scared of. We're driving along the highway and you lost your way and you ended up on Johnson Road, where Brothers Keeper took place, and you saw tractor parts and refrigerator parts strewn in the high grass, and that dilapidated little shack, and these smelly old farm brothers come out to greet you. You know, I think a lot of people would like shove their car in reverse and get the hell out of there. you know, with images of Deliverance North. Instead, we stayed and had one of the greatest experiences I've ever had in my life, which taught me so much about being judgmental, you know, and with Not Your Guru. You know, some people have criticized that film that it's such a positive, like, kind of promo for Tony. It's not. You can view that film any way you want. I wanted to give you a deep immersion into something that actually helped me tremendously dealing with some issues I was going through when I hit 50. And the experience of Tony Robbins and making that film really has given me a whole new perspective on life in a very positive way. And that is when I realized that was the film that I was least, you know, of all the projects I was pushing forward, that was the one that I was least thinking was going to happen. And through a lot of boring things that aren't worth talking about, that's the film that ended up occupying my next 2 years. And that's when I realized these films come to me at a time when I need the lesson that the film provides. And I think by doing this very emotional approach to storytelling where I'm just, you know, I never promise to give anything. I mean, we could talk about subjectivity and objectivity in documentaries for and filmmaking in general for a long time. I mean, I'm a believer there's no such thing as objective reality in anything, including a film.
As soon as you make an edit, you're taking something out.
Exactly. How you frame your shot. You know, the days you're not, I mean, Brothers Keeper, we shot on the weekends. So is that an objective film? We were only there on the weekends. You know, and where, you know, we learned from the great masters of cinema verite, Maisel Brothers, Drew, Penny Baker, all those guys. But those guys, particularly the Maisels, in their philosophy of direct cinema, felt that there is no such thing as a director, that they're capturing objective reality. And that's where I disagree. I am inspired and amazed at the craft and the idea of following real stories and giving them dramatic shape the way they did. But I disagree that you're capturing objective reality. That doesn't mean you're not telling the truth. You have an extra responsibility to be truthful. But for me, what the film is, it's the emotional truth of a situation. And really, it's the emotional truth of the situation that I'm experiencing over the time that I'm making a film that I'm trying to present to you as an audience member. It's why, if I could link it to Intent to Destroy, you know, why we're kind of here, I think. You know, it's the Armenian genocide is a subject that has fascinated me for a really long time. You know, I was.
Is that because it's been basically so underreported for so long?
Yes. The fact that something that was so obvious and well known in its day, 146 articles in the New York Times alone in 1915, the largest relief effort ever organized to date up until that point was the Near East relief effort, which was. Specifically an effort to aid Armenians while they were being slaughtered. It's a well-known chapter. It should have been a well-known chapter in American history, but the Turkish denial campaign has been so strong that most Americans don't know about the genocide or this chapter in American history where we were selflessly raising money for Armenian support. And so this idea that something can be so contested when, in fact, documentary evidence is pretty strong has always fascinated me. Also, as an American Jew, I have been somewhat, in my early years, obsessed with the Holocaust. And if you're invested in the Holocaust, you know its tentacles to the Armenian genocide for reasons we can talk about or not. But there's a deep connection between the Armenian genocide and the Holocaust. So I've always been fascinated by it, but I never thought...
Including the kind of denial, because we should talk too about the subtitle, Death, Denial, and Depiction, because that denial is very much a part of Holocaust.
Exactly. So I never thought that, you know, because I'm not a Talking Heads archival footage filmmaker, and because I feel like you need a present tense emotional journey to connect with an audience, I never thought that making a film about the Armenian genocide was something I would do. I mean, there's lots of things I'm interested in.
Because it might not even lend itself to your storytelling technique.
Exactly. But when I heard the promise was being made.
And this is the film about the genocide.
Right. The promise came out last year. It's a big budget Hollywood, quote unquote, Hollywood feature.
Directed by an Oscar nominated.
Directed by Terry George. When I heard that film was being made, then I thought, okay, I'm going to pitch these producers on giving me access to that set because I think this is a way that I can make a film that's comfortable for me. It's present tense verite, you know, following a film being made. So that's one. So I could make a film that has this journey that I could connect with, that an audience could connect with. But on a larger level, it also allowed me to tell the story of denial because to me, the basic facts of the genocide is less interesting than the idea that, about how stories can be twisted, manipulated, and erased from history, because I think we live in times now where that's happening in so many other ways. So the idea that the promise was being made to me was an opportunity to, A, do a present tense film, which is more comfortable for me, and B, because the history in Hollywood has been that this story has been rebuffed. You know, as early as 1935, Irving Thalberg was making an Armenian genocide-themed film. He was doing 40 Days of Musaddah, which was a very popular novel back then that had the Armenian genocide at its core because it was about a moment of resistance. You know, the Turkish government called the State Department and complained to our State Department that this film was being made, that the genocide didn't happen and Hollywood shouldn't make a film based on a novel that was a New York Times bestseller. And, you know, MGM cowered to that pressure from the State Department and stopped production on the film. And that's the way it's been for decades. And so now that a film was finally being made, it allowed me to tell that denial story.
We're going to take a break. My guest, who's always welcome here, despite what he thinks, is Joe Berlinger. His new film is Intent to Destroy. The treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. Talking to an old friend. It's The Treatment. My guest is Joe Berlinger, who may be the only filmmaker who's worked with the West Memphis Three, Oprah Winfrey, and Oscar Isaac. His new film looks at the Armenian Genocide. And what's interesting about this, too, is I was watching and thinking, wow, that's System of a Down. So this takes me back to Blair Witch, too.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, hey, you're one of the few who have made that connection. Yes. You know, Serge Tankian, who was in the film and also composed it, you know, I'm a huge fan of his. You know, System of a Down is a band of Armenian activists, and they sing very much about these issues. And Serge, you know, because of his activism, I interviewed him for the movie. And, you know, he said to me, do you have a composer yet? And even though I did, I have a longtime composer who I love, a woman named Wendy Blackstone, who's awesome. At that moment, I selfishly said, not really sure who's composing, just to see what his next comment would be. And Serge was like, hey, I'd love to compose this for you, which to me was a thrill. And, you know, with all due respect to Wendy, who's done an amazing job on my films, I felt for this particular film, somebody, you know, an Armenian who has been, an activist whose
life has been about this.
Yeah, his life and his art has been about the genocide. You know, I thought, oh my God, that nothing would be more appropriate than have somebody do the score. And the score is absolutely beautiful. And you wouldn't expect a score, you know, the sensitive, well, I would, but I think some people who deal in cliches about what System of a Down music is or whatever might not expect kind of the extremely sensitive and nuanced and, non-aggressive score that this became. I mean, I think it's just a beautiful score. When he first started sending me stuff, I was in tears at how beautifully it worked with the imagery.
There's something I've always wanted to say to you. I'm glad you're here now sitting across from me. I feel like your films are films that demand to be seen more than once because the first time, you're just hit by the emotional power of it. And again, I was talking about in the first half, that sense of discovery. I feel like we're living that with you, that you're seeing that. And just watching the making of The Promise, And the kind of investment that takes, and both literal and figurative, and the demands that takes, so it reminds us of what hasn't been done for so long. And you must get people to tell you that, too, because they feel they're hit by the movies in a way that they need some time. That's why I think you were talking about before, and I've been to screenings of your films, where people don't want to leave. They want to talk because they've been overtaken by this, and they need another time just to sort of sit back and take in the film on its own terms. You must find that to be the case quite a bit, don't you?
It's interesting.
I feel like that. At least it's the case for me.
My films have been criticized as being too long and really dense, so maybe that's the reason why people want to watch them over again.
But there's a lot going on in that.
Yeah, I do try to bring a lot to the table. I want films to work on multiple levels because I think, you know, I think some films, look, I'm certainly not going to tell how other filmmakers how to make films. But what doesn't feel good for me is to overly simplify things. I find life to be very complex. You know, I've never gone to cover a story that I've read in the newspaper without realizing that the newspaper article, even a comprehensive article in the New York Times, is just scratching the surface. And it never fails to surprise me, even though I know it over and over again, that when I go to a real situation that I've read about and I start covering it myself, it's so much richer and deeper. So it makes me question everything I read in terms of just how real, how deep. And again, that's not a criticism. It's the nature of reporting. It's the nature of needing a headline. And so I find life to be very complex, and certain issues, you know, it's why I included the denialists in Intent to Destroy, which, you know, my Armenian friends and a couple of genocide scholars, you know, have reached out to me to say it's really not a good idea to include denialists. In fact, you know, I had, there's one...
Is there a fear that you were normalizing them by putting
exactly
them in the film?
Exactly. And so, you know, a genocide scholar who I greatly admire, who's in the film and who I allowed, which I don't normally do, but the history is so complex, I allowed a couple of scholars to look at the rough cut just to make sure I was being accurate and there was no issues. And the reaction I got from two genocide scholars that I was expecting comments on, well, that you've left out that point, or this point is incorrect, whatever, because it's, you know, the Ottoman history is very complex to reduce the way I did. But I had an impassioned plea to remove the denialists from the film, you know, because the idea is among genocide scholars that, you know, you can't even acknowledge or give a platform to those who deny these historical events. And I was asked, you know, if you were making a film about the Holocaust, would you include denialists? And my answer was, well, if I was making a film about the Holocaust, I would not. But if I was making a film about Holocaust denial, of course I would. And this film to me is not just about the basic facts of the Armenian genocide. It's about how denial works, because unlike the Holocaust, you know, Holocaust deniers are considered fringe lunatics. Armenian genocide deniers are given, you know, a lot of respect and equal time. And to understand how denial works, you have to hear what the arguments are. You have to hear how historical facts are cherry-picked and thrown back at you in a convincing way to make you just shrug your shoulders and just give up. And that's precisely what is happening now. I mean, I wish I could say I was so prescient about making this film that I knew we would be in the world that we're in now when I first started it. But I started the film before Trump became president, but we live in a world now where on almost a daily basis we're barraged with alternative universes, and it's just said over and over and over again.
And people making their own facts.
And making their own facts. And, you know, if I'm just a regular person just trying to get through my day and get through my job and raise my family, at a certain point you just shrug your shoulders and you tune it out. And that's how denial works. It just, you know, if you say it long enough, hard enough. And so that's not an argument to exclude them from the film. If you're making a film about that phenomenon, which is partially what this film is about, you have to see it in operation. So I don't think I think it's very clear when you watch my film what my position is on the Armenian genocide. But I think it's important for the audience to hear some of these denial arguments, because it's, you know, I took images from the film and juxtaposed them with this new meaning. And you can see how, you know, if you switch between Fox and MSNBC on any given evening, you see this in action on a regular basis, the same imagery representing a totally different news viewpoint. But certain historical facts, there's no two sides to the history of most events. There's alternative perspectives. There's, you know, historians can argue about why something happened, but the fact that it happened is not disputed. And with this story, it's been kind of swept under the rug.
It's a treatment. So much to talk about with our old friend Joe Berlinger. It's always good to have him here. His new film as director is Intent to Destroy. I think, though, part of that gets to be that, for me, it gets back to being storytelling, where if there isn't conflict, then you don't have a story, right? Mm. I mean, and in simple terms, your films always work on a dramatic level. Mm. And that gets back to the kind of, if you're the Maisels or Fred Wiseman and you're trying to do that thing where you're just living in a place and showing all these things happening, then there are conflicts that come out of that, even under the guise of objective documentary filmmaking. You're still trying to find where that drama is. But for you, it's that, and it's the moment that happens in every single film with a certitude, somebody stating something that doesn't make any sense. Mm. And the larger point is that these aren't people who you can look at and say, well, obviously that's a bad guy or an evil person, even though the points of view that they're espousing are completely abhorrent in the context of the story and also in the greater context of people digging their heads in the sand. And there's a thrill to that for me.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, actually, again, that's why I love talking to you. I mean, I've always talked about how, you know, I think what our contribution to documentary has been is to take the verite or direct cinema philosophy and say, well, and push it a little further, to embrace dramatic structure, to embrace drama, you know.
And also to put it, to try, this is the first time you use a much larger canvas. Yeah. Generally, they're smaller stories, yeah, but you put them in a larger world.
Yeah.
This time you take a smaller piece of action and set it in a larger world, yeah, by showing us what's going on in the set of The Promise, but yeah, still working to that same point.
Yeah. But what I actually have never thought of until this moment is that a lot of the drama is conflict, and a lot of the drama does come from opposing points of view. And I think you've just given me something that I'm going to say in a future interview and take credit for it, because that's a great thought.
Well, nobody's going to know because nobody listens to this show. But I think, and I guess this is as much a question as a statement, so pardon me, but part of it is you have to stimulate yourself as you're making these things. You can't, if you're passive, it's because the film's making an argument that you agree with already,
right,
then the audience is going to be put in that position as well.
Right.
And you know how to create position papers.
Right.
But going back to the way we started the conversation, and we've had this conversation in one way or another since we've started talking, which is about, at a certain point, there's generally, like halfway into the book, I call the first act, the audience kind of goes, what? Because the film seems like it's going one way. And in fact, it makes a turn to go someplace else.
Yeah, it's true. Although, interestingly, you know, a lot of people were expecting the shoe to drop with Tony Robbins. Like, when are you going to criticize him? When are you going to show him to be full of shit or whatever? And the film never took that turn for me. But to me, that's precisely the turn, was that people were expecting the shoe to drop, and the shoe never dropped, because I'm just dropping you into that world, and you can decide what you want about that world, you know? For me, the films are about the journey I'm taking to try to understand my subject matter. And I think that's all I'm promising the audience. I'm taking you on my journey, you know? And as I vacillated about the guilt or innocence of West Memphis 3 in the day on the first film, Oh, yeah. I mean, while we were filming, by the time Damien was chained up in the last scene of Paradise Lost, you see Damien Echols chained up and being led off to death row, and Jason Baldwin being sent off to life without parole. And we had already seen Jesse Miss Kelly an hour before being, you know, sent to life without parole. Those moments were very profound, and we knew, I mean, that's when the advocacy gene in me awakened, and I knew that, you know, I could use film for social justice. But while we were, you know, we were embedded in that community for 8 months, and we vacillated, you know, before the trial started a number of times, you know. So we went down thinking we were making a film about guilty teenagers. We arrived a week after the arrests. All of the press reports coming out of Arkansas was that they were guilty. That on a scale of 1 to 10, the evidence was an 11. There was a confession in the newspaper. I mean, what brought us down to West Memphis, Arkansas, was this idea that we were going to make a film about how could three teenagers be so rotten as to do this horrible thing. And slowly over time, we realized that they had the wrong guys.
This always happens. We're out of time. I can't believe it. It's always so great to have you. My guest is Joe Berlinger, whose new, terrific new film is Intent to Destroy. You're welcome back here anytime.
Thank you very much. Great to see you again.
Good to see you. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Theo Mondo. The show is mixed by Kat Yores, edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I've been persuaded. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.